The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme, maternity care in rural Ireland in the early 20th century.
There was this kindness about these women. It was like they just faced things head on, and they loved their women and really tried to take care of them in a very vulnerable time.
We'll hear about a new exhibition honouring the work of community midwives. Also, race, politics and Irish America.
The Irish, you know, they fled these very disordered conditions in colonial Ireland. They fled these conditions in the motherland. But then they sometimes, in turn, they victimised the marginalised in the New World themselves.
Professor Mary Burke on shifting Irish-American identity from the 1700s right up to the modern era. And to begin this evening, we're opening up a new book on Irish food history, a gastronomic odyssey spanning thousands of years. Food. It's not just about filling your belly, it's a window into our past, a record of how we've lived, worked and celebrated through the ages. A new book takes a deep dive into Ireland's culinary history, from ancient feasts to modern innovations. The history of Irish food reveals so much about our changing culture, economy and way of life. The book is called Irish Food History, A Companion, published by the Royal Irish Academy. The co-editor with Dorothy Cashman is Dr. Máirtín McInumara, chef and senior lecturer in culinary arts at Technological University Dublin, who joins me now. You're very welcome back to the History Show,
Máirtín.
Now, you write in the introduction that our food history lies in the folds and crevices, like, for example, butchery marks in the bones of animals, where we learn that the first item, apparently, on the Irish menu is perhaps something you might not expect. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, again, this is from the opening chapter by J.P. Mallory, and he says that the earliest known item on the Irish menu was venison. And, you know, his reason for saying that is that they found evidence of butchery marks on deer bones, a reindeer bone, dating back to 33,000 years ago, found in Castlepook Cave in County Cork. So, you know, we would have thought that there were people living here around 10,000 years ago, but there's evidence now with the archaeology, the earliest we have of people, of human people here, is because of that butchery mark, is 33,000 years ago, around 10,500 BCE. So that's, you know, 12,500 years ago, you also have these butchery marks on the patella or the kneecap of a brown bear found in the Alice and Gwendolyn Caves in County Clare. And it's interesting because from that idea about brown bears being here, you know, Paula Meehan in her poem, The Solace of Artemis, she talks about that in every polar bear that there's a mitochondrial DNA which stems back from a brown bear that once roamed around Ireland. You know what I mean? So it's poetic.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You cite Paula Meehan because there's a wide range of sources and experts, obviously, that you draw on in the book that give us clues as to what people were eating at any given time. And a number of those sources are, well, a number of them are in the Irish language, and a number of them are from songs and poetry.
Yeah, well, I suppose I've always been searching for any and all sources for evidence of food. You know, food history is not, it's relatively new in Ireland, in the sphere of history. Like, really, you have, you know, A.T. Lucas, who wrote, you know, in the 1960s about Ireland before the potatoes, and then you had, you know, Louis Cullen. Louis Michael Cullen, who did great work in the 1980s and started to have two chapters in his book about food and about diet. And then, you know, the great guy named Fergus Kelly, of course, has done wonderful work with your early Irish farming and your beekeeping history and all this sort of stuff. But really, it's only in the last 30 years or 20 years that we've started to take it serious, and that has become sort of an academic discipline within courses and universities and stuff like that. And it shows, you know, the importance of, because people thought we didn't have a culture, that, you know, Irish cuisine was like an oxymoron. Do you know what I mean? So there was this belief, and it was a sort of a very misguided belief. And part of that as well is that there was a great Harvard historian called Hesiah Diner, who wrote a book about migration into America. And it was really about the Irish, the Italians and the Jews in New York City particularly, and spoke about their food ways. But in her book, She said that the Irish seldom, if ever, mentioned food in their songs or poetry or literature. And when they did, they never spoke about it in any discerning way. And straight away, I knew that was wrong because I'd grown up with songs and stories, but also not just in the English language, but also in the Irish language, since my father's from Connemara and we grew up with that rich Shannos tradition. And sure, Máire War, you know, she's the one who'd put the big potatoes aside beside the fireplace for me. You know what I mean? Like it was a sign of endearment, you know what I mean? And I was familiar also with the likes of, you know, Raftery's poetry, you know, Kiledon and Banisher and Slíhan War and all of these wonderful things. And also with there's probably the most amazing poem or satire or document of all is called Aisling Mac Cunlainne from the 12th century, which basically it's the first document of its type, and it's been copied all over Europe later on. This is from the 12th century, basically that presents a land of milk and honey, where literally he's going across in a coracle made out of lard on a lake made out of new milk, lands at a castle, you know, made out of bread and sausages, you know, for chains around the door, etc., etc. Like, it's just a fantastic piece. And that later on becomes in the English and the French tradition becomes the land of Cocaine, and then Schlaraffenland within the German tradition and all that. But all that basis is back here in the 12th century.
And there are clues in the language itself, you know, even in things like the Irish word for road.
Yeah, this is it. As in, you know, the idea about the cracks and the crevices is that, you know, most of this evidence is actually hidden in plain sight. Like the word boher, you know, which was for road, comes from bow, which is the Irish for cow. And even something as simple as buchel or Callin, your boy and girl, actually mean a cowboy or a cow herder, you know, and a little herder, as in Callin, Ian being the diminutive, you know, a small herder, you know, so that we were all cowboys, Ted, as they say. You know
and
what I
place
mean?
Names as well.
Place names, absolutely. Like this idea about the Clonmel, Clontarf, Capitagle, Glenageary, any of these places, you know, their real meaning are hidden unless you have the Irish language to decode them, because like Clonmel is Cluain Mala, the meadow of honey, or Clontarf is the meadow of the bull, Capitagle is the tillage plot of the rye, you know, and then what was it, Glenageary is the, you know, the valley of the sheep, you know, and there's thousands more Irish place names, food related place names all over the place and just hidden in plain sight, as they say.
And your own chapter in the book is 72 words for potato, which I presume is an homage to Malcolm McGann's 32 words for a field. Are there actually 72 words for potato in Irish?
There are indeed, and more, but again, it's not all direct words for a potato as such, but it's words used in for either groupings of potatoes, for different methods of producing potatoes, like in the production and in the harvesting of potatoes, etc., etc. So, and there was like within that, there was a triad in the Irish language called Thurskar, Prati, Poshti, right? So Thurskar is not just seaweed. Thurskar is cast up seaweed. And then that opens your mind to understand our ancestors, when there was a big storm, and again, there were certain times of year where there were storms, you know, there's Scarivín na Guach, and there's all of these different times, you know, a Rauartha, you know, like a spring tide where the seaweed would be cast up on the shore, that the people would go down, harvest that seaweed, bring it as natural fertilizer for their fields, you know, ensure that there was good potato crop, and when there was good potato crops, there was going to be poshti children. And we can see a direct correlation from, say, 1590, when you can see the potato sort of arriving or starting to establish in Ireland. We had around 1.1 million people, up to around the 1840s, when we had something like 8.6 million people.
And there's an interesting source from the early 17th century, which you highlight, the Parliament Chlinne Thomáis, in which you can pinpoint when potatoes became the dominant staple food, taking over from oats, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, I have to thank Nicholas Williams for this, who did great work on Parliament Chlinne Thomáis. And it was written in two sections and written down in Munster and Kerry. And so the first section was written around 1614 or so, and it mentions that the food of the common peoples were sruan curtke, which basically these oat cakes. And then by the second section, which was written around 50 years later on, suddenly they're eating the potati, they call them, you know what I mean? So it shows in clear evidence how the potato had taken grip and had become a food of the normal people.
Let's talk about well-fed Irish historical figures. Daniel O'Connell, who was a corpulent individual. Grace Neville writes about his correspondence, which offers some interesting insights into his eating habits.
Yeah, absolutely. The, you know, the letters of Daniel O'Connell are available, open access, on the Manuscript Commission online, and Grace has harvested from that some wonderful, wonderful chapter about his eating and drinking traditions and patterns and all that sort of stuff. And there's wonderful feasts, like there's the most succulent descriptions of the food he was eating down in Ivrahoch and having sent to him when he was up in Dublin or even in London, and also wonderful wines and that, but also his anxieties about getting too fat. He was writing to Mary, his wife, saying, "I'm getting corpulent, I'm getting fat," and all this sort of stuff. And she says, "I love you as you are, don't be losing any weight," and all this sort of stuff. And even he speaks about doing his Lenten fast, but some of his Lenten fast doesn't sound too hard because he's eating fish all right, but it's the best of turbot, and he's eating the best of wine and Burgundy stuff to go with it.
And the book is also peppered with poems describing incredible feasts. I mean, you've already talked about Anthony O'Rafferty. There's one in particular you wanted to highlight, the Irish Jubilee. Tell us about the Irish Jubilee and what the basis of that poem is.
Yeah, the Irish Jubilee, I heard there was an organisation called, they're still going, Seanos Cuisliffe, but my father was involved in setting it up with a number of others years ago. But I remember being at a Sunday night session in Hughes's pub, and one of the Gaelic singers sang the Irish Jubilee, and the first time I heard it, and I says, I have to learn that because it's so rich with food. And I found Barry Gleason had it recorded on Pats Across the Ocean. So I learned the words and I learned, and I've been performing it regularly since. But it goes on for around 15 minutes, so we won't do that. I won't subject your listeners to that. But when I traced the history of it, it's about an Irish-American senator called Doherty who was elected to the Senate. And the whole thing was that, was it, they made me their senator to show them me gratitude. We'll have the finest supper ever given in this latitude. So he sends out invitations and everyone comes, and then they all sit down, and finally the food is laid out on the tables, And it goes, he says, "Oh, we ate oatmeal till we could hardly stir about. Ketchup and hurry up, sweet kraut and sauerkraut. Dressed beef and naked beef and beef at all its trousers on. Soda crackers, firecrackers, Cheshire cheese with breeches on. Beefsteaks and mistakes were down upon the bill of fare. There was roast ribs and spare ribs and ribs that we couldn't spare. Oh, reindeer and snow deer and dear me and antelope. And the women ate so much melon, the men said they can't elope." So you can see how
the ponometer has been going, and I think we registered at least a dozen in those. It's only not even two verses.
Not at all.
Your co-editor, Dorothy Cashman, writes about perhaps the most influential Irish cookbook. Tell us about Cookery Notes.
Cookery Notes, what Dorothy has done, Dorothy's a brilliant detective, and there was a cookbook, it has to be the most widely published cookbook ever in Ireland, because it was basically for sale for around 70 years, and it was reprinted so often, but it was published originally by the Department of Agricultural and Technical Instruction. But one of the things that really, I suppose, irked Dorothy was that there was no evidence of who wrote it. And again, through archival research, and particularly with the Department of Agriculture, a librarian, Dorothy discovered that the author of this amazing cookbook, Cookery Notes, was actually Marion Laird. And Marion Laird was an instructress in the Munster Institute in Cork from June 1903 to August 1925. And effectively what Dorothy discovered is that her authorship was effectively anonymised by the department on payment of a gratuity for her work. Now, Dorothy goes on in her wonderful chapter to actually track down other authors of various cookbooks, because Dorothy's original PhD was on sort of culinary manuscripts, and she realised that actually cookbooks as we know them, printed cookbooks, didn't really appear in Ireland until post-famine. And really there's a glut of them after independence in 22 and later on around the time of the Second World War or such. But she's identified wonderful writers. And strange, also, there's two instructresses that she found. These are people who were involved with the domestic economy, which was something that was happening from around the 1890s onwards, and these schools of cookery. But she found that two particular instructresses, illustrate the tensions of the time, Nellie Gifford and Elizabeth Bloxham, both from unionist backgrounds and both actively involved in the struggle for independence. So these were redoubtable women who have not been accorded the standing or recognition that they deserve in the historiography of Irish cookbooks. And this is an omission that Dorothy has put right in her wonderful chapter.
In a chapter by Ian Miller, Hunger and Starvation in Modern Ireland, there's an example of how no family was ever that far away from hunger. He tells the story of the Sullivan family.
Absolutely. When this chapter came into us as editors, like it really bowled us over, because the historiography we've been taught was people dying of hunger, that's something that happened in the 1840s and the 1850s, but, you know, particularly post-independence, that it was something we had to worry about anymore. And here we have, I think it's around 1826 or 27, you have the Sullivan family down in Cork, who at one stage were middle class and actually had a decent enough farm, but they used to sell their goods to the British Navy. And suddenly, post-independence, that was gone. They found themselves sort of down on their luck, and they were actually starving. They went looking for relief, but because they had a farm as such, they were deemed to not be poor enough. And they went home, and they went home and starved and died. You know, shocking stuff. But there's other examples as well, given in Dublin, given down in Roscommon, etc., at different stages during the 20th century, of people found dead of starvation in their small homes, whether they were tenements in Dublin or whether they were in small little country homes.
And just to return to the potatoes, strangely, it appears that there's actually a deterioration in the Irish diet after the famine, because, well, it's related, I suppose, to the fear of over-reliance on the potato. Diet changes, but it doesn't change really for the better.
No, and again, you know, Dr. Miller has done a lot of work on this in the past. He has clearly found that the post-famine diet in Ireland was far worse, because when we were eating potatoes and when we were eating oats and milk and butter and, you know, a bit of herring and a bit of maybe bacon or whatever, you know, it was quite a balanced diet. And actually, the evidence shows that the British politicians thought the Irish men were the strongest and Irish women were the most beautiful, you know, at this stage. But come post-industrial revolution, when people start moving into cities, and again, with factories and all that sort of stuff, there was a big push towards tea and sugar and bread and spread, as in jams and things like Marmite or that sort of stuff. You know, the barrels are meat compote sort of thing that would be spread on bread. And that diet, it kept the working classes going, but was far inferior to what they used to eat when they were eating the porridges for breakfast and when they were eating the potatoes, and that which was nearly a perfect diet.
A World Away from Potatoes, Bread and Tea is one of the chapters. It's a study by Elaine Mahan. Diplomatic dining.
Yeah. Elaine was a student of mine in Cahill Brewer Street years ago. And again, she did her undergrad thesis first on looking at diplomatic dining. She was inspired by a paper that she saw about Michael Kennedy in the Royal Irish Academy, who edits the foreign affairs stuff,
yeah.
You know. And the whole idea about Sean McBride and these guys like actually dining for Ireland over in London and Paris and sending bills back to Michael Collins and asking Michael Collins to send them money. So that inspired her to actually do her PhD on how the Irish state developed diplomatic dining post-independence. And in this particular chapter, she's a full book on the subject coming out with Peter Lang next year. But in this chapter, she looked just really at Áras an Uachtaráin from 1922 to 1940 as such, or she looked at how the thing developed up until the Second World War. And it's fascinating, because originally with the new state, diplomatic dining would happen in big hotels first, places like the Shelburne or the Metropole. And gradually then, when the forecourts were rebuilt and suddenly Dublin Castle was available again, that was used for the first time with the Eucharistic Congress in 1932, and later on then for visiting dignitaries. And then there was, Douglas Sahide would have garden parties and small dinners up in the Áras. And unfortunately, you know, Douglas Sahide got quite ill, but he had these great plans to actually hold dinners to bring people who had been on different sides of the Civil War together, you know, to try and create unity again and build up through food, because food is such a powerful tool. As they say, the soft power of food, it's wonderful.
Now, food history provides amazing sources for social history. Is it becoming more popular?
It's becoming so much more popular. I've been going for over 25 years now, I think, to the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cookery. That started originally in 1981 or so. And so this is happening. People from all over the world come to that. In 2012, we set up the Dublin Gastronomy Symposium as a biennial event. And again, it's been going from success to success. And again, this is our eighth year running the Masters in Gastronomy and Food Studies in TU Dublin as well. And a lot of the students there do their master's thesis on food history. I had a student last year who did her thesis on the history of coddle, Dublin coddle, you know what I mean? And again, getting back to Paula Meehan, Paula Meehan's great-grandmother was one of the last madams in the old De Monto, you know, what became Foley Street, the Montgomery Street, the old Monto. And Paula had her recipe for cuddle. And all the family used to get together on the Sunday morning and around the big pot of cuddle. And there was lungs and all in there, as in the lights, you know what I mean? And seemed like they used to go brown with boiling, Paula was telling us, you know. So everything, you know, history is hidden in plain sight. Something very simple. I'm always like, you know, just constantly like a magpie looking out for things. And I'm also interested in ballads and songs. Listening to the opening sort of soliloquy to MacAlpine's Fusiliers, Ronnie Drew would say, "I come from County Kerry, the land of milk and bacon. And if you think I'll eat your fish and chips, you're very much mistaken." So I'm straight away thinking, OK, this was written around mid-40s. So clearly there was no chippers in Tralee. And actually, their famous chipper in Cork, Lennox's, I believe, is closing down at the moment. And that opened in 1951, you know what I mean? So all of this, everything that happens every day is actually history, you know what I mean? But it's important to just to keep your eye open for it and to look for all and every sources to tell the story as best you can.
Well, the book, and it's a hell of a tome, it's big, it's a doorstopper, is Irish Food History, a Companion, a Gastronomic Odyssey from Hunter-Gatherers right up to Modern Irish Cooking, featuring 28 essays, and we've just touched on a few of them tonight. It's published by the Royal Irish Academy. My guest is the editor, Dr. Martine Muckanumra. Many thanks for joining us, Marcia.
Can I say just one thing before we go, is that the book is also available open access for free through EUT Academic Press. So anyone who wants to tap into it, it's available online for free. I'm confident that anyone who actually dips into it online for free will see how beautiful it is and will want to go out and buy a copy of it because it's so beautifully designed by Brenda Dermody and this lovely version that the Royal Irish Academy has put out.
And
thanks, William.
Called once again Irish Food History, a Companion. Martin, thank you very much for joining us. And after the break, we'll hear about the work of community midwives in early 20th century Ireland. Stay with us. Welcome back. In the early 20th century, long before hospital births became the norm, community midwives were the backbone of maternity care in Ireland. These women provided crucial, often life-saving care to mothers and babies working in rural areas where access to doctors and hospitals was limited. They travelled by foot or by bike, carrying their medical bags through all weather, and often stayed with families for days at a time. Their work was vital in a time when childbirth carried significant risks, and they became trusted and respected figures in their communities. A new exhibition, Mary Ann Fanning, Remembering Our Community Midwives, is currently running at the National Museum of Ireland Country Life in Castlebar. It celebrates the often unsung contributions of community midwives to maternity care in Ireland in the early 20th century. A project by the Irish Community Archive Network, the exhibition is researched and curated by Emma Laffey, a local historian and a healthcare assistant. And Emma joins me now. You're very welcome to the History Show, Emma.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you started looking into the history of community midwives when you were researching your own family history, didn't you?
I did. I am part of Skehanna District Heritage Group here in East Galway. And I did a little genealogy course and I just said I'd see what was there for my own family. But I remember from a long time ago when I went up to Donegal, I was brought up by our own family member up there when I was just 15 because he knew I had an interest in local history and heritage. And he had told me at the time when he brought me to my great-grandmother's old house that she had died there as a young woman. She was 43 with seven young children, with the youngest found still feeding from her. So it always stuck in my mind, I suppose, over the years. And when I did the genealogy course then, I said, I'll go and see if I can find her death cert. So as it turned out, she did die at 43. And on her death cert had written cardiac arrest, maternal exhaustion. So it really prompted a lot of questions, as you can imagine, with what prompted her death at 43 with exhaustion. Was it poverty? Was it an underlying condition? There were so many questions. And I suppose it wasn't until later years that I started working in a maternity setting in Portiuncla Hospital as a healthcare assistant. I seen firsthand the work midwives do. So it brought all this back to the fore for me. And I said, I wonder, is there much written on these women, the midwives, who, like, I wasn't sure whether it was a handy woman or a midwife that would have been around her at the time. So on investigation, then I suppose I noticed there wasn't very much written about them. So that's really where it prompted it all from.
And the result is a book on Van Glooyne, The Woman of the Knee, Irish Midwives and Midwifery. We'll come back to that presently. But this is the first time an Irish Community Archive Network project is the focus of an exhibition at the National Museum of Ireland. So let's talk about the exhibition. It's centred around Mary Ann Fanning. She worked as a district midwife and nurse primarily in Garristown, County Dublin, over the course of a 48-year career. Tell us a bit about her and how you came to learn about Mary Ann Fanning.
Well, Mary Ann Fanning is a great-great-grandmother of my children with their dad's side. So I would have heard them speaking about her, I suppose, over the years. And with this research into midwifery, I just said I'd ask Pacelli, who is the family, she's the family historian there. And she said to me, we've a lot of stuff still belonging to my granny. So they had her bag, which is on display. They had a christening gown. They've so many documents and memorabilia belonging to her. So really, she started off her career in the late 1890s and worked, as you said, up until 1948. So they also had a photograph of her from 1910. So really, there was a lot of earlies about this lady, especially when the Midwifery Act came in 1918, where it was compulsory to have your education to work as a midwife. So I thought she'd be a great start, I suppose, for the exhibition and a great face for these women.
And is the Gladstone bag that she used, is that kind of the centre of the exhibition?
The Gladstone bag is one of the things centred in the exhibition. And the reason being is it was involved in a 1916 rising in Ashburn, the Thomas Ash Raid. She rendered medical aid to the volunteers there. Now, they did have family folklore about this as well. And it was always great to get the black and white, because in her obituary, they have written that she was part of that 1916 rising, rendered medical aid.
Now, you, as you say, you work in a maternity setting yourself at Pádraig Ó Tuilleadh Hospital in Ballinasloe. How would your professional life, do you think, contrast with the professional life of Mary Ann Fanning?
Well, there's supposed to be a lot of things to be similar. There's an awful lot of stuff still similar in her bag that's used today. I suppose the huge difference now is everything is medicalised and more in hospital rather than home births. I suppose the care of women, I suppose things aren't as familiar to women as they would have one time. They would have known their community midwife. She would have lived among them. She would have been very familiar face. She would have delivered their mothers and their aunts and other, you know, neighbours and friends around, and they would have had a huge trust in them. So I think Pádraig Ó Tuilleadh now, they're trying to bring back some of this community feel. They run a midwife-led clinic so that they have the same faces when they come in for each appointment in their antenatal clinics. And it's really just to relieve anxieties for women and try and get them to feel like this is a normal thing for women, pregnancy and birth, and try not to be, you know, too nervous about it.
Now, you've used the term, you mentioned the term handy woman. And that was a term that was used to describe midwives. But these were people who weren't formally qualified. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, they weren't qualified, but every village would have had one. I suppose it was a precursor to the midwife. And this handy woman would have, I suppose, laid out the dead. She would have done all the births, any sickness that was going on. And as I'm still researching, and I was out in the Aran Islands, there still too was men that did some of this work with the dead. And I've actually found two men that are willing to speak about their grandfathers and fathers that did this. And they would have shaved the men and washed the bodies and cleaned them all down. So there's still a huge amount of work I have to do and research in the handy women section.
And in relation to Mary Ann Fanning, have you been able to talk to people who, you know, who were delivered by her or who were her patients?
There has been some of them, I won't be able to name names, but they have such, there was actually, I actually got a text message, believe it or not, on the day of the launch from a man in London who heard about the exhibition from somebody in New York, which I found fascinating in itself. But his mother was delivered by Mary Ann Fanning, and she has nothing but fond memories of her and her going around on her bike. And this lady is now in her middle 80s living in London. So it was a really lovely text message to get that morning. It just shows how important, I suppose, the value on highlighting these brilliant women and the work they did.
We're going to hear now the voice of a community midwife from the RTE Radio Archives. In a 1983 edition of the programme Looking West, the 81-year-old Bina Kelly was interviewed by RTE's Jim Fahey. Here, Bina evocatively describes her experience of visiting a home to assist with a birth and all the worries and also the excitement associated with that day.
I'm not sorry for all the hardships. There were many. But there were many good days and many joys. And it was lovely at that time to visit the homes and witness, if I can explain it right now, the big difference there is in now and in them days. You were called to a village on the case. You may never have known or seen that patient before. You walked in, you met the little children in the kitchen. The husband was worried while he was taking you there. The neighbours was there to help. And those little children, they ran to meet you. They ran round. And I always thought, will they have their mother when I'm finished? It was really sad. I didn't know what I was facing. But then, when labour was over, there was the joy. Her husband was waiting for the good news. He had witnessed the worry and what she has going through. Always children realize when their mammy is not well. They weren't themselves. They were worried, but they didn't know why. They just hadn't their mammy. And when the baby was born, the joy to the mother and the father waiting outside a window or a door for the news. And when could he see her? And when you had things ready and you let the little children see their new baby, sister or brother, and they all had to get a kiss, it was one of the joys I'll always remember. And you couldn't imagine the kick it gave me. It was worth all the worry and all the trouble.
The voice of Bina Kelly speaking in 1983 to Jim Fahey, recalling her work as a community midwife in rural Ireland during the first half of the 20th century. And what a poignant line that was, where she's talking about the children of the woman who was about to give birth, and she's wondering, will they have a mother when I'm finished? Emma, along with Mary-Ann Fanning, Bina Kelly is one of the women featured in your book on Van Gluyne, Woman of the Knee. Now, that recording it's a great historical document, but she was someone who was full of anecdotes about her professional life as a midwife.
Oh, yeah, she absolutely loved her work, even though she was terrified at times of what she had to face, as she said herself there. There was this kindness about these women. It was like they just faced things head on, and they loved all of their patients and they loved their women and really tried to take care of them in a very vulnerable time. You have to understand that women had, there was no running water, no electricity. They literally spared everything. There was no sheets on the bed. She said at one point they might have some, if they're lucky, made out of flour bags. It was really difficult times, very, very difficult times.
And her bag was very important as well. I mean, it was famous. The bag was almost as famous as she was.
It was. And it's really a line that goes through with all of the midwives. The children, I suppose, at the time, the magic of the bag was that they thought the babies used to come out of them. But with Bina, there was a big SOS out because she went into a labouring mother. And when she came out to retrieve her bag, it was gone. So the Gardaí and the whole lot was called out in search of the bag. And as it turned out, it was the school children that took it. They were looking for a baby next door as well. And they thought if they took the bag, they'd get one. So, I mean, innocent times, but hard times too. There's some lovely stories around them.
And are home births making a comeback?
There is a home births there. I know, well, I'm not a midwife myself, but I know it's on the increase. But it does come with a lot of, I suppose, criteria. You know, you have to have no big medical background going on with you or anything like that. Everything has to be pretty much straightforward. It's still slow on the rise because of litigation, as you can imagine, but it's still there and it's happening. And we have a lot of good midwives trying to bring this back as a choice for women and giving women back their choices.
well, they can be reminded of what midwifery was and what rural midwifery was in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the exhibition. The exhibition is called Mary Ann Fanning, Remembering Our Community Midwives. It's currently running at the National Museum of Ireland Country Life in Castlebar, County Mayo. My guest is the curator, Emma Laffey, who will be giving a talk at the museum, A Life from a Midwife's Bag, this coming Saturday, the 19th of October at 2 p.m. And we link the details on our own website. Emma, many thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And after the break, I'll be joined by Professor Mary Burke, author of Race, Politics and Irish America, A Gothic History. Stay with us. Welcome back. We are right in the middle at the moment of a US presidential election season, which, not for the first time, has some odd Irish resonances. Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance, for example, in his 2016 memoir Hillbilly Elegy, describes himself as identifying with the millions of working-class white Americans of Scots-Irish descent who have no college degree. For her part, although her heritage is unlikely to entice her to Ireland to research her genealogy, Kamala Harris is descended through her Jamaican father from a particularly enthusiastic Irish-born slave owner, Hamilton Brown. In a recent book, Race, Politics and Irish America, Professor Mary Burke of the University of Connecticut explores Irish-American identities. Note the use of the plural. Earlier, I spoke to Mary about how the history of Irish emigration and its intersections with race, class and culture have shaped these identities. So Mary, Irish emigration to the USA begins to take off in the 18th century, but there were a couple of distinctive types of emigration. So can you differentiate between pre- and post-famine Irish emigration?
I think we know a lot about post-famine, but pre is interesting. So only about a third of Ireland's population were Protestants, you know, in the 18th century, but they constituted 75% of transatlantic departures between the years of 1700 and 1776. And about 70% of these Protestant immigrants were actually Presbyterians of Scottish settler origin. And by 1790, half of the 400,000 US residents who were, you know, usually labelled Irish, these actually descended from this particular Ulster stock.
Even in the 18th century, you identify different waves of Irish emigration. So how were the earlier emigrants different from those who left Ireland, say, after the devastating famine of 1741?
Yeah, so the first wave of emigration from Ulster occurred from 1718 onwards. And that wave was, you know, made up of those who could raise the cost of their passage. But the second wave, which started about 1740, this was different. This was poor indentured servants. And James Leyburn, the great sort of scholar of the Ulster Irish, he estimates that, quote, not less than half nor more than two-thirds of all white emigrants to the colonies were indentured servants or redemptioners or convicts, end quote. And he suggests that at the beginning in 1728, by far the greatest number of servants actually came from Ireland. You know, it's a truism that we hear a lot that the post-famine Irish, they were racialised and then later whitened, you know, how the Irish became white and all that. But I think the Scots-Irish were also initially portrayed as being, you know, ambiguously between white and native. And this was due to their role as a bulwark between Native Americans and longer settled white Europeans. And they sort of perform this role on certain frontiers. However, you know, their status does eventually change and they acquire the much more white Anglo-Saxon label of Scots-Irish. And this sticks, really sticks, after the famine influx of poor Catholic Irish.
Now, one of the best known Scots-Irish figures was obviously President Andrew Jackson, whose own brother was born in Ireland. Jackson would generally be dismissed as irrelevant to Irish America. Yes, ironically, he's closer to Ireland than JFK or Joe Biden in generational terms. So what does that tell us about Irishness in the USA?
I suppose it tells us that we need to expand, you know, our common and very narrow definition of what is Irish America, which I think we tend to presume it's post-famine, it's white, it's Catholic. But, you know, if you think about the wider, deeper context of the history of the Americas, and I'm using the plural there, if you think about that history, then the Irish have been a presence there for close to 400 years. And I suppose I'm going back to, you know, the forcibly transported Irish in a 17th century plantation zone. And this zone would have stretched from Virginia down into the Caribbean. And then you think also of something like, you know, the Ulster Irish, who were a presence in America before it was ever formally recognized as a country.
Jackson was, and I quote from your from the book, an enslaver and a scourge of Native Americans. Irish people, I would have thought, would probably not be too comfortable with their American heritage being vested in figures like Jackson. But is he actually such an outlier?
Not so much. So, yes, I'll just sort of explain his reputation first. So he instigated the infamous Trail of Tears, and that was the forced westward migration, which thousands of Native Americans died. And he was also an enslaver later in life. You know, I'm naming him as a villain here, but that's not to imply that maybe, you know, Catholics fleeing sectarian Ireland had some kind of innate sympathy then for the oppressed in America. And I found it enlightening really to think about the family and the work of Margaret Mitchell in this regard. Mitchell is, of course, the author of the bestseller Gone with the Wind, very problematic, really a celebration of an Irish slaveholding family called O'Hara. Mitchell spent much time at her family's ancestral Georgia house, and that had actually been a slave plantation. Her family were of Tipperary Catholic gentry origin. They had built this plantation on land that had been cleared of native presence by no less a person than Andrew Jackson in his early military career. Mitchell's family history, it suggests that the Irish of any and every stripe could be culpable in dealings with peoples of colour in America. I try to stress that the Irish, you know, they fled these very disordered conditions in colonial Ireland. They fled these conditions in the motherland. But then they sometimes, in turn, they victimised the marginalised in the New World themselves. So there was kind of an unthinking replication of everything they were fleeing from at times.
In 1798, the US Congress passed a number of exceptionally illiberal laws. So these were called the Alien and Sedition Acts. There is an Irish association. Tell us how the 1798 rebellion in Ireland actually influenced the passage of these illiberal laws.
I guess I was interested in the fact that it was the radicalised Irish of all stripes, you know, who were involved in the 1798 uprising. And it's important in this context as well to remember that that was, of course, influenced by the French Revolution. So the build-up to 1798 was part of the impetus for these acts that you named, the Alien and Sedition Acts, that were passed by the US Congress in that very year of 1798. So the acts were a response to a very strong perception in the 1790s in America that French and Irish, what were called alien forces, that they were conspiring within America. So there was a congressional debate on naturalization, and it was sort of stressed during that, and I love this quotation, that, quote, hordes of wild Irishmen with their incendiary political ideas, that they were not welcome in the land of the free. So at the heart of America's first Gothic novel from 1799, just a year later, and this novel is called Edgar Huntly. So there's a character in this who's an Ulsterman who has done violence in his motherland, and then he flees to colonial Pennsylvania. And I think that this novel suggests that the threat of Irish radicals felt very, very real in the American imagination.
In recent years, there's obviously been a lot of debate in the USA about the notion of white slavery, citing the status of Irish labourers in the Caribbean in the 17th and 18th centuries, the so-called Red Legs. You emphatically describe this as pseudo-history. How did this idea gain currency, and why is it pseudo-history?
So pseudo-history is inaccurate but still popular history, and I think it's gone very viral indeed with the internet. So I'm not going to minimise the suffering or the premature deaths of, you know, many of the Irish who were transported, or even, you know, the deaths of voluntary immigrants, people who went to the 17th century Caribbean. I'm not going to minimise that, but I will stress that the Irish slave rhetoric, the white slave rhetoric, this creates a really false equivalence between indentured servitude, which was brutal but temporary, and the systemic enslavement of people of African origin and their descendants in perpetuity, which was, you know, a very different thing altogether. And I think another complexity to remember, if we're thinking about the Irish, you know, as victims, is that in the Caribbean, they were both planter and deportee. And sort of the abject status of the transported Irish shouldn't, I think, efface the role played by some elite Irish there too. I'm really struck by a place like Montserrat in the 17th century in the Caribbean, for instance, which was dominated by a rapacious Irish planter class of predominantly, you know, Catholic Norman origin.
How were the post-famine Irish represented visually? You cover this quite a bit in the book. I'm thinking of the cartoons of Thomas Nast, for example, the simianization of the Irish.
Yeah, yeah. So this racist visual representation, you know, of the Irish, it drew from how African Americans were depicted as ape-like, you know, and so the Irish were drawn as low-browed and, you know, physically repulsive. And I think written descriptions also stereotyped the Irish. So it was coming at them, you know, from multiple directions. And that stereotype was that they were lazy and treacherous. And I think it's interesting to remember that the Ulster Irish were also initially, the Scots-Irish, initially stereotyped in this way too. There's a 1780s description of this Irish cohort from New York State. And it noted, and I'm going to quote it here, "The Irish do not prosper so well. They love to drink and to quarrel." And of course, that sounds really strikingly like, you know, the later stereotypes of the famine Irish.
Were women, Irish women in particular, or Irish American women, were they subject to simianization as well?
Yes, especially, you know, working immigrant Irish women such as maids. And my book reproduces an interesting 19th century comic Valentine card, which mocks a so-called Irish beauty who possesses, you know, ape-like features.
Now, you've already you mentioned Gone with the Wind, Margaret Mitchell. A lot of people will not realise that in Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara's father, Gerald O'Hara, is an Irishman from County Meath, hence the name of the estate, Tara. He has fled to America after getting in trouble in Ireland. You begin your introduction with a fascinating story of a proposed sequel to the novel. What happened there and what does it tell us about Irish America and race?
Yeah, so a few years ago, the Gone with the Wind estate, they asked Pat Conroy to write the sequel to Margaret Mitchell's blockbuster of 1936. He was a fellow Southerner, a fellow Irish American. However, it laid down, the estate laid down what are, to me, very Irish American conditions, that there could be no homosexuality and no interracial marriage. So after a few months of, you know, struggle and unsuccessful negotiation, the very exasperated Conroy, he presented the estate with the following opening involving the man that plantation belle Scarlett O'Hara marries, Rec Butler, and another for whom she perennially pines, and that's Ashley. And this is the opening. "After they made love, Rhett turned to Ashley and said, 'Ashley, have I ever told you that my grandmother was black?'" So Conroy's very irreverent anecdote, I think it packs in so, so much. It suggests divergent interpretations of the past between the Irish of different generation or different political outlook. It suggests diverse Irish-American attitudes to race and sexuality. And I suppose on the most basic level, it shows how many seemingly American cultural productions have very strong Irish contexts.
The assumption in Ireland is that the famine's legacy drove Irish-American support of radical nationalist movements in the 19th and early 20th century. However, you also emphasise something I find very interesting, amnesia regarding the famine.
Yeah, so the famine was indeed a powerful motivator within Irish-American nationalism right into the 20th century. But for many actual survivors, it was unnameable. The famine Irish, they were stigmatised, they were, you know, off-white refugees. So they had to suppress that shame, really, in order to, you know, join the white establishment. I found a really interesting example of this was Eugene O'Neill's very successful stage actor father, James. James O'Neill's autobiography neglects to mention that he fled famine as a child. So Eugene's drama is kind of mindful of those kind of traumas and of famine and so on. But I found it very striking that his survivor father wouldn't or couldn't write about this experience himself.
Now, you'd be aware of the controversy over the denaming of the Berkeley Library in Trinity College because of Berkeley's enthusiasm for slavery. Given that John Mitchell's aspiration was for, as you quote in the book yourself, and I this is a direct quote from John Mitchell, because we've got to be careful with these things, a good plantation well stocked with healthy Negroes in Alabama. That's what he wanted above all. And he was a very effective propagandist for the Confederacy during the US Civil War. So in that context, do you think it's time to reassess his contribution to Irish history?
Well, sure, yeah, it's definitely time to do that. But I think, you know, Mitchell is not some unrepresentative bad apple. I think he really points to a failure of a certain strand of Irish nationalism to make common cause, you know, with other oppressed groups, especially, you know, Native Americans, African Americans. Mitchell had, you know, broken with his former nationalist ally, Daniel O'Connell, and O'Connell had worked to align the causes of Irish nationalism and abolitionism. By contrast, Mitchell, you know, after he escapes to America, his original sympathy for the plight of the degraded Irish poor, this turns into sympathy for what he called the oppression of the slaveholding American South by the North, which, of course, is another, for me, another false equivalency. And I think we need to maybe reassess Irish American history as a whole in relation to race, not just in Mitchell's individual case alone. You know, I'm very struck by, you know, certain facts. For instance, the last illegal transport of human chattel from Africa to the United States was actually undertaken as a waiter by a first-generation Irish-American businessman called Timothy Maher, who was of Kilkenny Jacobite Catholic gentry descent.
And one of the things that surprised me in the book was that that happened in 1860, so only a year before the beginning of the Civil War.
Right.
Theoretically, everything named after John Mitchell in Ireland could be revested in his grandson of the same name, a World War One era mayor of New York, without changing a thing, without changing the name at all. But tell me, why would that be unlikely in the case of John Purroy Mitchell, who was, I think, far from being a chip off the old block where the granddad was concerned?
Yeah, they're a really interesting pairing. So I'll start by saying that in my book, I think about how surnames down the male line are understood as some kind of evidence of loyalties, denomination or ethnicity in Irish America. So I found that the Ulster Presbyterian John Mitchell and his New York mayor grandson with the exact same name, that, you know, they were an interesting case to explore what happens when this kind of assumption doesn't hold true. So Mayor Mitchell, he was at odds with the politics of his grandfather, but his ancestor's reputation among New York's Irish nationalists, it absolutely bedeviled the mayor's public life. He was plagued by it. Mayor Mitchell was raised Catholic, but his republicanism and his reform politics put him at odds with New York's Irish political machine. I think most interestingly, he took on the corrupt Tammany Hall, the Irish Democrat seat of power, as a young lawyer. So the youthful mayor's reformist bent made him very popular with the broader electorate, however, and he was given one of the largest public funerals ever seen by his city at St. Patrick's Cathedral. St. Patrick's, of course, being the symbol of the aspirations of the Irish Catholic, New York. So a very thinly disguised Mayor Mitchell actually made it into an F. Scott Fitzgerald novel as a hero. So Mayor Mitchell, he was, you know, an Irish-American icon in his day. He's forgotten about to a huge extent, but he certainly wasn't an icon in the mould of his grandfather.
When do you think the Irish finally became white? Was it as late as JFK's accession to the throne, if you like, in 1961, or had it already happened before then?
Yeah, so I'm thinking about, you know, I think the Irish whitened a few times, but in terms of the post-famine Irish, I'd go back to 1956, which is 4 years before Kennedy's election. And that is when Grace Kelly, a woman of famine generation roots, she ascends to the status of Princess of Monaco, in a ceremony that was broadcast live and watched by 30 million people. So that very extravagant ceremony was also explicitly Catholic in a period when Catholicism was still stigmatized in America as the religion of, you know, not quite white immigrants. So I think her globally, this very globally visible ascent, this altered the social status of Irish America. And I think that she paved the way for the rise of another family of famine roots who were called, and I don't think this is a coincidence, America's royals, and that, of course, being, you know, the Kennedys.
And indeed, the so-called curse of the Kennedy dynasty is a dark chapter you also explore in the book, but we'll have to leave it there for now. Professor Mary Burke is the author of Race, Politics and Irish America, A Gothic History. It's published by Oxford University Press. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.